Well, once again, I appreciate being invited to be with you this evening. And as Barry said at the beginning, when I was reflecting on what I might want to title this evening's talk, the title that came to mind for me is Sentient Speech. The Buddha used the word sentient in a pretty broad way, S-E-N-T-I-E-N-T. And by that, when he would speak of sentient beings, he was talking about all living beings who are capable of experiencing Vedana, that, which is to say, all beings who receive stimuli and judge it to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. All beings who are capable of suffering, as well as those, you know, as well as capable of experiencing pleasure. So, this evening, I'm using the term in a somewhat more narrow way, combining the Buddha's teachings on wise speech with a focus on that form of speech, the purpose of which is to evoke an emotional response. And so I'm going to contextualize it in two different ways this evening. One is by way of a sort of a personal story of speech from myself to myself, okay. Me as the speaker and me as the listener. So kind of an internal focus. And then the other focus this evening, which seems timely for us, is political discourse, political speech. How do we take in that which we hear being said? You know, the rhetoric of political discourse. How do we understand it from the Dharma perspective? How do we participate in it, should we choose to do so? How do we comport ourselves in the realm of public speech or public discourse or political speech in a way that honors our teachings, the way that honors our own values when it comes to participating in public dialogue about public matters? So, so as I said, I'm speaking about speech tonight in two ways, which is that which you utter to others and that which you hear uttered, you as the speaker and you as the listener. And the Buddha's teachings on what constitutes wise or appropriate speech are equally applicable. You know, his five criteria for a wise or beneficial wise speech certainly apply to our discerning our own intention before we speak, but it can also be a very insightful set of teachings in terms of discerning intention on speech that we hear. Why is that person saying what they are in the way they are? What is their intention? What are they seeking to elicit? And both of those ways of reflecting on speech are really important, both for, you know, our relationship to ourselves and also certainly our relationship to the polis, you know, to the greater social community. So, since most of us are seasoned yogis, let's see if we can rattle off together what the Buddha's five criteria for wise speech are. Okay. Whether it's timely,
true.
Whether it's truthful, whether it is useful, yes, whether it fulfills a useful purpose or not.
Kindly intended.
Kindly words, kindly spoken. Okay.
It's spoken gently.
Yeah, right. Kind words, kindly spoken. Right. And the fifth one that's sometimes included, if we think about the Eightfold Path, you know, in terms of the eight spokes on the Dharma wheel, you know. We have the three meditative factors of tranquility, of mindfulness, of wise effort that forms the basis that allows the mind to become clear and open and stable, so that then we can begin to gain insights, you know, the two wisdom factors. One is insights into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are, you know. Everything leading in our past, every strand of conditioning that's ever affected us in one way or another that leads us up to where we are at this point in time. And in one way, the Buddha talked about, you know, this right view or right, you know, or wise understanding is in terms of dependent origination. You know, if you gain insight into the interactivity of all phenomena, how everything gives rise to everything else, and then it changes, and then it passes away, and this continuous process, including ourselves, including our notion of self. Okay, so all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are up until this point in time is one of the wisdom factors. The other one is insight into intention. All the causes and conditions giving rise to who we may be in the next moment. And we bring ourselves into being, you know, we have the meditative factors, the wisdom factors. We bring ourselves into being through the media of speech and action and way of life. You know, the three, what are sometimes called the fruition factors, or sila. So if you're, you know, ever in an Asian temple in Thailand or one of the other Southeast Asian countries, one of the things you'll find on every altar are incense and candles and flowers. And the incense is representative of the meditative factors. Okay. The candles are the light of wisdom, the wisdom factors. Okay. And the flowers are fruition, the coming into being, the manifesting of our wisdom and our meditative capabilities in terms of how we live our lives. And so among those three, the one of speech, right? The Buddha said where the freedom lies is in this interface between intention and action, or between intention and speech. Okay. So it's like, you know, those giant oil tankers have just a little, only about 1% of their length is the rudder. But moving the rudder just a little ways, one way or the other, can shift the whole vessel in one direction or another. So a saying in Tibetan Buddhism is that all rests on the tip of intention. So looking at this interface between intention and action, between intention and speech, you know, if we can discern in time what our intention is, in speaking, then we become much more likely to speak in a way that is wise, that is useful. Okay. If we are overwhelmed by emotion of one kind or another, then what tends to happen instead is less skillful speech. Okay. Because we weren't able to discern intention before blurting it out. So how to hold, how to be with, you know, these elements is really key to kind of living our practice. So, I'm working on a book now, writing one. I've just begun, and the working title is Making Peace with Memories. It's about Buddhism and mindfulness and post-traumatic stress. And in the process of doing so, I've been doing a lot of reading, a lot of background reading on the psychopathology of trauma and traumatic stress. And I've come across this kind of theory of brain structure that I know a lot of you are probably familiar with, and I have no professional background in this at all, but the neuroscientists talked in terms of saying, well, you know, we think we have this one brain that runs the whole show. Not so much. You know, that's actually three different brains that try to work together to the extent that they can. You know, one being the medulla oblongata, or the reptilian brain, the one that was the first to evolve, and the one that seeks to govern these very, very basic life-sustaining functions, like respiration and the pulse, you know, the cardiovascular system, you know. It's a really good thing that we don't have to remember to breathe, isn't it? We'd all keel over from time to time, right? So there is this aspect of the brain that takes care of that stuff for us, you know, real basic level stuff. And then the next one up is what's called the mammalian brain. And that is the one that is the network that governs emotions. You know, powerful negative, powerful positive emotions. And it's related to the reptilian brain in that if you think about, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness, for instance, mindfulness of breathing in the body. That's actually mindfulness of what the medulla oblongata is up to. Mindfulness of vedana, of the mind's judging all input to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Kind of a combination of the reptilian and mammalian, okay? Especially powerful emotions. And in the brain, within the mammalian brain, there seems to be a particularly powerful system called the limbic system. That is the one that is responsible for the generation of and the transmission of powerful emotional states of mind. Okay. And then the medial prefrontal cortex, up here, the reasoning part, the analytic faculties, you know, lie there. And when things are working right, at least these three brains are in kind of communication with each other. And the stimuli come in, and that's basically the third foundation of mindfulness, is mindfulness of, you know, the arising of emotions, mindfulness of the arising of thoughts, looking at the, you know, at the mind's analytic capabilities of what's going on. So when things are in balance, then these kind of communicate with each other and they do what they can to work together, you know, like three horses hooked up to the same chariot. What happens in with people who experience severe or prolonged trauma, okay, is that the limbic system is powerfully overloaded again and again and again, to the point where, like, you know, a lot of studies of children that grow up in very dangerous environments, either because there is violence within the home itself or they live in a dangerous area, or children who are raised in a wartime situation, there's so much firing that goes on in the limbic system. The responses are so to life-threatening stimuli are so strong that part of the brain actually develops a more powerful circuitry that makes it really hard for the rationing, you know, the rational capabilities to function properly. So, for instance, when I was in Vietnam, more than once, you know, I was serving up on the demilitarized zone between what was then North and South Vietnam, and on more than one occasion, you know, the unit I was with, you know, our lives were probably saved by close air support of fighter bombers flying really fast and low right over our heads, and laying down, you know, either bombs or napalm as a way to keep us from getting overrun. And so I associated that noise, you know, with my life being saved, but also if we didn't duck and cover, then there is some possibility that our lives are going to be threatened as well. These are split-second decisions going on. So the mind became very attuned to that stimuli and what to do in response to it. I came home from Vietnam. 4 days after I came home, I was registering for classes at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And just outside of Tucson is Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, and there was a training squadron for the same fighter bombers that were flying close air support when I was in Vietnam. And so for the first few weeks when I was on campus, walking from classroom to classroom, every once in a while, I would find myself lying on the ground under a car. And my books and papers were scattered all around me on the ground, and people were staring at me, you know. And it was this really, really powerful conditioning that may well have helped save my life in one environment. But then the stimuli, in a completely different context, my response was inappropriate. And it took a long time for me to condition myself to where I could hear that stimulus and not have that automatic reaction, that, you know, overreaction that turned out not to be all that appropriate. What does all this have to do with speech, one might reasonably ask? So here's the first story. I serve as sometimes as a naturalist and environmental historian at Bar Lake State Park, which is a 2,000-acre reservoir up near Brighton, and it's a wildlife refuge. And I went up there one day last week to, there's about a 10-mile road around the perimeter of the lake, and so I took my bike up there. I was going to ride around, take some pictures, and so I put my fairly nice camera that I use for conservation photography, and then I had this water bottle. I put those both in my saddlebag and put them in the back of the car, and drove up there. And the water bottle that I had brought with me was one of those kind that has a little flip top, you know. And for anyone who owns one, you know they leak notoriously. So I got there to Bar Lake, and I went to get my stuff out. And sure enough, the water bottle leaked into the saddlebag that had the camera happily in its case in it. And so I just started, you know, really kind of fuming at myself for having done something so thoughtless. And I took the camera out of its case, and it hadn't saturated the case yet, so everything was really okay. But I was just really, really ticked at myself. And then I started taking the bike off the back of the car, and I was agitated and not paying careful attention to what I was doing. So I scratched the back of my car with a bike. You know, Hillary Clinton used to talk about having a bad hair day. I was having a really bad head day, you know. It's like, and there was just something about that concatenation of events that triggered absolute fury in me against myself, you know. And I started just cursing myself up one side and down the other, using language that I hadn't since I was in the military. And it was just horrific and kind of almost breathtaking in its power. You know? And it really took me aback. It was a very, very humbling experience when it occurred. Because it was horribly unskillful speech, for the most part, from myself to myself. It was not beneficially intended. It was maliciously intended. It was speech intended to harm me, to hurt myself, right? Whether it's useful is a more interesting question. Michelle McDonald, who is a meditation teacher, teaches at Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, and it helps teach long retreats in particular. She gave a talk once where she was saying, when you're on one of these long retreats, you have this notion or this idea of what it means to be a good yogi, you know, and to watch the mind and the arising and passing of all phenomena and so on and so forth. And that occasionally ill will arises toward yourself or somebody else. And she said, on a long retreat, eventually that stuff just builds up, like in a pressure cooker. And she said, when it gets to a certain point, and that seems to be the only place the mind is going, she said, you really need to do something about it. And she says, you know, whether it's you sitting silently on your cushion, you know, you can you can let her rip just internally with, you know, all kinds of unskillful speech, whether it's directed to yourself or another or whatever. If that doesn't suffice, you can go out walking in the woods and, you know, and when you're really alone, you can, you know, say out loud some of the stuff that's on your mind. But she says it's really pretty important to engage in that kind of catharsis every now and then. Just really flush out, you know, like being your own spiritual roto-rooter, you know, just kind of really go at that stuff and get it out, let it be out there. You know, make manifest the hidden dragon. And she said it's useful to do that. It can be useful to do that because it acknowledges what's in there and brings it forth, and in so doing, it releases it. And I remembered that. I also remembered a couple of occasions in the Pali Canon where the Buddha really lost it, where he, you know, he just chewed out one of his yogis up one side and down the other and went for really harsh speech, you know, very hurtful speech, you know. And the guy that he really got mad at was somebody who was out saying, well, the Buddha said this, the Buddha said that, and the Buddha calls him and says, I didn't say that. Where are you coming from? You know, you don't have a clue. And it was, so there were, at any rate, I was oddly comforted by that. You know, I remembered that. But then I had to have a close look. What is it? What was it that caused me to unleash such fury on myself? You know, because powerful afflictive emotions coming out of the limbic system is two things that triggers them. You know, usually, basically, what triggers them is threat. The being, the self, feels threatened, severely threatened in some way, and so it triggers that fight, flight, or freeze response. And as I really investigated that, you know, why was I excoriating myself in that way? Insights really began to arise, and I remembered my parents were loving, but my father was a fairly harsh disciplinarian, also quite a perfectionist. He's the only person who graduated in his family who graduated from high school during the Depression, and went on to earn a PhD and was on the faculty at the University of Arizona. But his expectations for me were very high, you know, in terms of just, you know, how I just doing chores around the house, but certainly everything having to do with going to school. And I was guilty of a grave sin, as it turns out, that I wasn't fully aware of until my parents reported to me what my guidance counselor reported to them, which is that he gets these great scores on these tests, but he's not living up to his potential. And so I was constantly at home in this state of, you know, you need to be doing better than you are. You need to be applying yourself. You need to be, you know, disciplining yourself. You need to be working harder. And I felt always as if I were, to some degree, under attack almost, right? And as it happens a lot with people, with kids who are raised that way, you begin to internalize the external messages. And so, you know, as in junior high and high school and whatnot, I would begin to excoriate myself. You know, I would give myself a really hard time if I didn't study hard enough or I didn't get a good enough grade on a test or something like that, because somehow or another the mind thought that if I was a harsh enough self-disciplinarian, it would protect me from having to be disciplined externally, you know. And especially you mix that in with, you know, wartime experience and whatnot, and it's kind of a toxic soup. And so just as a result of these things that happened to me, you know, in that little moment there, I suddenly got, you know, why am I re-traumatizing myself in this way? You know, it's just nothing more than this kind of conditioning that was going on. And having taken me to the core of hateful speech, speech intended to hurt, okay, it's somehow also for me put me in a little bit better touch with what it feels to me like is going on in our political discourse right now. Because if you listen to a lot of what's going on, especially that speech, which is harsh and which is condemnatory, and which, you know, much of it is aimed at the limbic system, right? It's not encouraging reason. It's encouraging fear of or hatred of that political figure who may do you harm, who may be a threat to you, either because of their policies or because of their unfit character. Okay. So that speech is actually intended to create fear so that it blocks out one's ability to reason. Okay. So that same thing, that same dynamic is going on, you know, in public discourse as sometimes happens internally. One of these interesting parallels that I come across and from time to time when I was teaching the professional ethics course in the School of Public Affairs in Denver, CU. One of the texts that we read was Aristotle's book on rhetoric. And book two, it was one of the first times, certainly in Western civilization, that a group of folks had actually tried to govern themselves based upon their own deliberations rather than just ceding authority to a monarch or, you know, a warlord or somebody. And instead, they, you know, well, let's get together and talk about it and see if we can come up with a course of action. And what he realized was that in order for this to occur well, you really needed to sharpen your skills at speaking and listening. And so he did, in some ways, the same thing the Buddha did. He said, when you listen to speech, or when you're getting ready to speak, you should be aware that most speech falls into one of three categories. You know, when you're seeking to discern the intention of the speaker, what it is they're trying to convince you to do. He said, most rhetoricians will go about the craft by one of three kinds of appeals. One is appeal to reason or logic, which you call logos. One is appeal to notions of justice or what is right, okay, which you call ethos. The third is appeals to passion, pathos. And he said, when you get well attuned to listening to rhetoric, you can begin to discern which form of rhetoric the speaker is using and why. Appeals to passion are basically ways to, just like now, ways to try to stimulate the limbic system. If you arouse passion strongly enough, it tends to cancel out our ability to reason. And we respond or we react out of fear. We respond or we react out of a strong affinity for one candidate or a really powerful abhorrence of another one. So, in reflecting on these things, I think just as was the case for me in my business with the camera and the water bottle or whatnot, I think that it's really helpful for us as well to follow Aristotle's advice. You know, whether it's rhetoric that we're hearing or whether it's political speech that we may be getting ready to engage in, what is our intention? What is our motive? You know, are we resorting to logos or pathos or ethos? What is it that informs our ability or impedes our ability to live the Dharma in the way that we engage with others on matters that are kind of affecting our future? So, mindfulness, I think, for me, is a little bit kind of like, and you know, Thich Nhat Hanh used to talk about this. He used to say that just as we need to be very mindful of what we eat and drink, and so far as the well-being of the body is concerned, we need to be really mindful of the information we let in terms of the mind. Sometimes I think about mindfulness as sort of the liver and kidneys of the spirit. You know? And it's that careful, mindful listening that the Buddha recommended, you know, discerning the intention of the speaker, discerning whether it's an appeal to passion or to logic or to some notion of justice, you know, because that tells us a lot about the intention of the speaker and what they're trying to get us to do and whether we agree with them or not. It's become really important for me to start doing certain kinds of self-care that I didn't realize are as important as I think they are, especially in these times. One is, you know, if you're speaking publicly, tend to refrain from trying to convince others to think or see things in a way that they are not inclined to do. So just as the Buddha said, don't proselytize when it came to teaching the Dharma, I tend not to try to make somebody else hold a different view than I think they do. But, you know, for exchanging views, simply to state mine and the values that they're based upon. Going on a news diet, you know, have this incessant habit of checking the news all the time to see what the latest breaking stuff is, you know, which way what it might portend for the future of our country. I think there's great value, and I'm better at this some days than others, of just either limiting to a certain period of time, okay, or a certain time of day for inspecting the news, and then doing something else with the mind altogether. Go outside, move around. take comfort in the isness of nature, you know, just things as they are, rather than as we might wish them to be. And I'm finding it useful to spend a little more time in meditation than I have been for a while. And spend a little bit more time trying to remember where the center is and that place of inner refuge that makes it possible to interact with the outer world in a more skillful way than might otherwise be the case. So if anything I've said has, you know, raised a thought in your mind or a question, now's a good time to share it. Do you have any thoughts or reflections or anything you'd like to share with regard to what I just said? Please.
I'm just curious, what is your intention tonight?
My intention tonight, you know, it's like, I think it's a good question, I appreciate it. I think most of us, you know, and I was, one of the things that came to mind for me as I was going on this self-tirade, you know, among the thoughts that came up is, who the hell do you think you are to sit down in front of groups of people and pretend to know something about the Dharma, you know? If after 40 years of practice and 20 years of teaching, you still find yourself treating yourself this way, what have you learned? You know, you ought to just throw in the towel and take up Sufi dancing. You know, this is there's no point. You know, you're hopeless. You know? And so, and actually, pretty much every time I sit down in front of a group, you know, there's that, oh, you really know what you're doing? So I think most of us who teach the Dharma from time to time teach the lessons we need to hear. And this is stuff that's really been on my mind for a while. Because when it seems like political discourse has kind of become an open sewer, you know, and a lot of the really toxic negative ads are not trying to convince somebody to do something. They're trying to convince you to not do something, which is just step away. detached, disengaged. This is so nasty, especially don't vote, just forget the whole thing. For me, it's become really important, not number one, not to do that. I think some form of mindful, non-dual engagement is really important at this point in our time for those who feel so motivated. But what has been on my mind is that it seems that sometimes for me, my knowledge of the Dharma and the extent to which I try to embody its teachings gets kind of detached or attenuated from the realm of political discourse, and that I'm not allowing my lived knowledge of the Dharma to inform and to influence my participation in public discourse to the extent that I think it should. And so basically what I'm talking about tonight, as much as anything else, is the issues that I'm sitting with and I'm working with and I'm struggling with in terms of trying to bring those two closer together. Ann Richards, the former governor of Texas, a few months before she died, she was well along with cancer, and she was out on the road. She was doing fundraising tour for women's shelters around the country. And she gave a talk in Denver where somebody asked her, the political climate is not with you. You've been turned out of office. You're pretty ill. How is it that you can continue to do the work you're doing? What makes it possible? She said, you have to find the courage to talk to people you don't know, tell them things they don't want to hear. to try to be a mindful participant in public discourse at times like this requires a certain amount of courage. It requires the sure and certain knowledge that you'll probably blow it sometimes, but the steadfastness of intention and the ability to try to bring some higher level of consciousness and some degree of goodwill to bear on the matters before us is important. Very long answer to a very short, simple question. Thank you.
Please. So the Buddha's common name was Gotama Shakyamuni. And that's interesting already because it means he's from the clan of the Shakyas, which is the lion clan. But Muni is one who is still or silent. So in the Sutta Nipata, there's a chapter on the Muni, the one who is still or silent. And in that chapter, it says that the one who is still does not look at another as inferior or superior or even equal to oneself. Because moving beyond self, you've moved out of the realm of comparison. And so I think of that in the context of what we tell ourselves about ourselves, which can be dangerous territory if we're not careful about that. So we think, oh, I'm really good at this, or I'm really great at that, or I'm really better than this other person. Well, I'm really no good, or I really screwed up here. Why do I always make the same mistake over again? If it's something more than just seeing unskillful action and resolving, okay, maybe I don't do that again, then there's all this internal turmoil that has to do with the stories we tell ourselves. And they're all involved in comparison. Ourselves versus another, better, equal, superior. And it's all tied up in this morass of self. So one of the very helpful things that I think you're bringing to us is to be cautious about what we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Quite so.
Fixed, and then we're going to live out that role.
Quite
and
so.
None of it's very helpful. Be careful what you tell yourself about yourself.
Yeah. And don't believe everything you think. Yeah. Yeah.
Where you put your water bottle
to. Huh? I'd say again what you just said.
Be careful where you put the water bottle.
Yes. Yeah, it's important. Yeah, someone once asked, you know, why do this practice? Or what's the chief benefit? And one of the answers I give is to learn to be a better friend to yourself. You know, to be like a spiritual friend to yourself. You know, the Buddha, the Jesus of Nazareth said, you know, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. It's sort of transactional. What the Buddha said was, see yourself in others. What harm then can you do? You know. So the link between the two stories I told, one of them is that going to the depths of that self-excoriation, you know, that harsh speech intended to frighten, actually, being able to touch that root made it possible for me to understand a little bit better the nature of some public discourse, you know, and that I am not separate from that, in that those roots are within me as well, you know. And woe be unto those of us who are unaware that they're in there, you know. Because then it makes it harder for us to not hate those who are speaking in ways that we don't agree with. You know, Sharon Salzberg, in talking about metta, says, put no one out of your heart. Doesn't mean you have to accept them or like them or whatnot, but as soon as you put somebody outside your heart, you create this separation, you create this dualism. Yeah, please.
Sorry, and have a lot of compassion for the poor woman who's been raped by the pirates in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to also remember to have compassion for the pirates in the South China Sea who are raping the woman, because, you know, given their past, given their history, given their conditioning, given their opportunities, that's what they ended up doing. And who's to say that you, in those same history, opportunities, whatever, wouldn't be doing the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to look at all the people who are saying these crazy things, all the people who are consuming the false news and mm-hmm. spouting it and believing these weird things, and it's easy to just kind of look at them and go, God, how can these people be so stupid?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if we'd had their circumstances, we might be the same way.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear to me that a lot of people who are putting out this stuff are in just terrible spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And
those pirates live in hell.
Yes,
you know,
the
ones that Thich Nhat Hanh was talking about.
He who shall not be named is also living in hell. And there are times when I have to admit that gives me some satisfaction. I'm not proud of that feeling.
Were it not for its effect on others.
And there are times when I'm able to hold compassion for that and to think, but as I said, there are many challenges out there for developing our compassion.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. I just had a thought based on what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are sort of the three forms of mind, and the way the limbic system is more automatic.
Oh, yes.
Head all you find all that other stuff frustrating, then being driven by your limbic system is kind of easy because it's so automatic, and it feels, if you let go, you let yourself into rage.
Mm-hmm.
You're not questioning your conduct. You're not saying, am I doing the right thing? You act with this sense of certainty.
Yes.
And I think people are very confused about that.
Yeah. We were having a similar discussion in the Sunday Night Sangha in Denver, and someone was saying, you know, is there no appropriate place for anger? Because sometimes the manifest injustices that are occurring, you know, and in my retreat teaching over the years, I'd say probably at least to the fourth of the women I've interviewed with are dealing with the after effects of having of some kind of either physical assault or severe psychological trauma associated with their gender, you know, and there is palpable and understandable rage and anger toward their perpetrator. And so this notion of what, you know, is anger bad, is anger good, what do you do with it, you know, I think number one is to acknowledge it, honor it. The anger arises out of a sense of threat, right? I think that for us, the challenge, you know, in Dharma practice is how do you then transmute that anger into something constructive or positive? Not to deny it, not to try to suppress it, to acknowledge it, to honor its existence and what it's trying to do, but then to look at, are there ways that that energy can be used more constructively? Number one, perhaps just to protect myself from something like that similar happening, and then in addition to protect others. So for me, that's a lot of what the Me Too movement is about. It's people who really have been harmed, who are seeking to transform society, you know, who are finding some degree of empowerment, number one, just acknowledging what happened. And then second, to say, you know, we should no longer continue to live in a society that simply accepts that as the way things are, because it's a huge source of suffering. And the Bodhisattva path calls upon us to do what we can to bring that suffering to an end. Just as I've brought to an end our 2 hours together. So if we could just for a moment settle back into our sitting posture. Reflect our own intentions for a moment in coming here tonight and sitting together, in co-creating a place of refuge, in practicing the Dharma together, finding that still, silent space of having noble conversations with noble friends and dedicating the fruits of those conversations and those intentions to the well-being of all and to the cessation of suffering. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava buddha nubhavena. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava dhamma nubhavena. Sada soti bhavantu te. By the power of all the dhammas, may you always be well. Vavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sada Sote Bhavantute. By the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May you always be well. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Have a safe journey home.